A Story Publishing presents When Violets Whisper. The morning is not newborn, but composed, as though the day has been sitting straight-backed for an hour already, and now at last gives its polite cough to set concord in motion. Fog stipples the stubbled fields, lifts, then lingers like someone reluctant to leave a good story unfinished. In that hush, a faint perfume, violets of all impossibilities, floats over two very different houses. No one comments, most hardly notice. Yet the scent persists, the same in both places, as if a single breath has crossed class lines without asking leave. Sunlight enters the Hollinghurst Manor through blown glass panes, polite enough to avoid the cracks in the sash. The house built in 1838, white clapboard, four proud columns, a lawn no longer quite as wide as memory, wears its diminished fortune with the stubborn dignity of an aging general. Buttons polished, frayed cuffs hidden beneath the coat. On the landing, Clara Hollinghurst pauses before the oil portrait of her great-great-grandmother. The woman's eyes, stern beneath a lace cap, have been lecturing generations on posture and duty. Today, though, Clara sees something new. A pinprick of violet light at the painted pupil, a shimmer there and gone. She blinks. Gone indeed. She leans closer until she almost fogs the varnish with her breath, but the portrait returns to its customary disapproval. Clara tells herself she imagined it, yet her pulse hurries as if she has overheard a secret. A breakfast chime rings below, silver on china, brisk, unmistakable. Lateness, her mother often says, is the first discourtesy. She descends. Eleanor Hollinghurst sits at the mahogany table's head, monochrome in narrow pearls, a ledger of household tasks open beside her teacup. At the opposite end, James Hollinghurst slouches, tie crooked, face pale from pleasures best left unnamed. Between them, Edward Hollinghurst studies the business section with the intensity of a man hoping numbers might forgive him out of pity. Mrs. Pritchard, the housekeeper, 17 years in service, soft-footed, invisible according to family preference, sets down a gleaming bowl of soft-boiled eggs and retreats without creaking the floorboards. Her departure is so deft, the spoon's tap on porcelain sounds louder than it should. "Good morning, darling," Eleanor says without looking up, voice smooth as starch. "Morning," Clara answers, nearly swallowing the word. She takes the seat three chairs away, the one that catches sunlight and gossip in equal measure. James offers a conspiratorial grin. Someone left their shoes in the hall. "Not me, this time." The grin dissolves before it finds courage. Edward clears his throat. A single syllable, James, carries reproach, apology, and exhaustion. They eat. Cutlery whispers against china. Conversation, such as it is, revolves around chipped saucers, Latin revision, and whether the gardener can be retained for one more season. Clara fingers the edges of a contraband library book, Mary Kingsley's Travels, hidden beneath her napkin. She imagines paddling upstream toward lands where no one schedules her afternoons. Her mother's voice snaps like thread. "Clara, sit up." "And after tutoring, Mrs. Shelby expects you to finish the white work for Sunday." "Yes, mother." Neither parent sees the thought that crosses her mind, a child's fierce desire to be somewhere else, capital E, undefined. Clara stands the moment etiquette allows, murmurs a dutiful excuse, and heads for the stairs. That violet fragrance rides the air again, sharper now, as though the house itself has crushed a handful of petals underfoot. Half a town away, Concord wakes a second time. The Esposito house, also white clapboard though peeling, porch rail mended with salvaged lumber, raises its own music. Clatter of enamel pans, kettle whistle, a language humming beneath English vowels. Maria Esposito, flour on her forearms, flips bread in hot oil. Widowhood taught her efficiency. Four children keep her fluent. Carlo, her husband, moves behind her, broad-shouldered, engine grease beneath his fingernails, a half-finished whistle leaking from cracked lips. He catches Maria's eye, remembers too late the parish meeting he promised Father O'Malley, and mutters an embarrassed prosody. "I'm going, I know. that earns him a forgiving nod. At the table sits Anthony, Tonio Esposito, 12 years old. Hair untidy, trousers rolled above scuffed shoes, he drinks in the room the way thirsty men memorize a well, cataloging exits, moods, obligations. Marco, the brother lost to factory fire in Naples, left silence in his chair. Tonio keeps filling it, never quite enough. Lucia, age 7, barrels in. Prosody rate slow. The squirrels are stealing all our nuts, Tonio. Sister Donahue says they'll take ours too. Tonio ruffles her hair. We'll be fine, Piccolina. Squirrels only steal from children who skip their arithmetic. She gasps. Arithmetic is sacred at St. Bernard's, threat neutralized. Breakfast, fried bread, slivers of salt pork, 3 lonely apples from their tired orchard. While Maria pours chicory into mismatched mugs, Tonio peers out the back door. The autumn air smells wrong, cool, clean, and laced with violets, a scent he knows only from church on feast days when women pin corsages to statues. A breeze rattles the apple tree. It creaks like old timber then. He hears it distinctly, Tonio. Whispered, syllables caught in bark. He steps closer to the threshold, heart misbehaving. Prosody Raything all right? Maria asks, dabbing her hands. Wind just changed, he answers, wary of sounding fanciful. He grabs his bicycle, errands cannot wait for ghost gusts, and pedals into Concord, the perfume trailing him like a rumor he can't outrun. Concord's commerce unrolls modestly, a milk truck coughing along cobbles, a grocer stacking oranges in a pyramid too ambitious for the season, shopkeepers setting out signs that promise more than inventories can deliver. Stone church, green-painted clock tower, granite curbstones polished by decades of school shoes. Clara exits the post office under pretense of returning a library book, the Mary Kingsley now snug in her satchel. Freedom lies in small lies, she tells herself. She strolls past the bakery, sugar wafting out, and the ironmongery, rehearsing rebellions confined to her skull. On the town green she sits, opens her book, fails to read. A bell rings 9:30. Crows gossip around the fountain. She inhales for courage, tastes violets. Impossible. She glances up, searching for a dropped sachet, a passerby wearing too much cologne, nothing. That is when she sees him. Across the street, a dark-haired boy props a bicycle with one hand. His clothes are patched clean, his posture coiled. He surveys the square as though mapping exits, not attractions. Their eyes meet, one heartbeat, maybe two. Clara looks away first. Proper girls don't stare. Something electric settles beneath her collar. Tonio checks the grocery receipt in his pocket, pretending the moment never happened. Carlo would scold. You don't borrow trouble with old families. They collect interest. Yet he finds himself rooted, listening for the faintest confirmation that the air is, indeed, perfumed with familiar, not nameless longing. No confirmation comes. He pushes off, wheels rolling toward the eastern road. Clara watches him go, chastising herself for curiosity. Still, she notes the cadence of his departure, the slight wobble over a paving stone, the way he eases past the church gates, as if she might need those details later. Behind them, the green resumes its usual hush. Only crows, only the fountain, only buildings shrugging deeper into September. Beneath the ordinary, the violet scent pools like ink. By late morning, the clouds part, granting Concord a pale, unseasonal heat. Clara, a bundle of thwarted explorations, chooses the long route home, down the cow path, into woods that cradle Walden. She relishes the hush. No Latin drills, no china spoons, only leaves turning papery at their edges. Each step draws the perfume nearer, as though violets grow wild in the underbrush. They do not. On the pond's far shore, Tonio arrives by an older track once used to haul ice. He drops his bicycle against a stump and walks, arms loose, pretending leisure is a chore assigned by fate. In his pocket, a stub of Marco's pencil pokes his thumb, a small penance he carries daily. Above the tree line, a hawk circles, silent witness. The shoreline bows them toward each other like magnets set in reverse. They do not yet see. Instead, they share an uncanny synchrony. Both pause, both breathe in, and both feel. The word will come to them later, observed. Water laps the mudbank. A single ripple shivers outward as though something brushed the surface from below. The perfume intensifies, sweet yet metallic enough to raise goose flesh. At the same instant, Clara and Tonio lift their heads, searching opposite horizons. Clara presses a palm to her chest. The world has gone sharply specific. Reed shadows, dragonfly wings, her own pulse counted against lapping water. Somewhere, someone is watching. Tonio kneels, fingertips grazing damp sand. For a flash, he thinks he sees his brother's reflection beside his own. Marco, older, solemn. He blinks, only sky remains. The feeling lingers, a presence older than loss, older than Concord itself speaks. Distance prevents it, and awe forbids it. They stand until the violet scent thins to nothing, until the pond looks ordinary again, until sunlight winks off ripples like coins a stranger tossed. Clara closes her book without remembering a single word. Tonio brushes sand from his knees, half convinced the wind has just whispered his name a second time, half ashamed for hoping it would. They turn away, she toward the estate, he toward the workshop, each carrying the inexplicable inward. Nothing visible has changed, yet both sense the furniture of their lives has shifted an inch to the left, enough that familiar rooms will feel strange when next they enter. Behind them, Walden lies still, reflecting the wide September sky, keeping its own counsel. And though the violets leave no trace, the air remembers. Evening slipped into the Concord woods like a rumor. Amber, uncertain, separating leaf from shadow one slow inch at a time. Clara picked her way along the western track toward Walden, knees brushing blue-eyed grass, brittle with September fatigue. She had slipped out after the final, bitter mouthful of Latin tutoring, declensions still fluttering uselessly behind her eyes. The Mary Kingsley volume in her satchel felt less like reading and more like ballast. Tonight, she meant to be unaccounted for. Pine needles muffled her boots, giving the path a chapel hush. Somewhere ahead, a bird sang twice, sharp and questioning. On the breeze drifted that impossible note of violets, as though the hour itself wore perfume. Clara closed her eyes, letting the scent steady her pulse, and stepped through a last screen of bramble. Walden opened before her, a slate oval rimmed with reeds that leaned in as if to overhear. Across the water, near the eastern stones, a boy she recognized from the town green, Anthony Esposito, called Tonio, knelt beside a pail, a stick and length of string in his hand, hadn't seen her yet. The smallness of the scene, how utterly it belonged to the hour, made her cough a greeting before she thought better of it. Tonio jerked upright, almost dropping his makeshift pole. For a moment he studied her, lanky, serious, hair pale where the lowering light caught it. He said nothing. "I didn't mean to startle you," Clara managed. "I'm not staying long." "No one stays long," he answered, voice dry. "Mosquitoes see to that." His wryness unraveled what little hauteur she'd brought. She stepped closer, careful to leave a respectful distance, boots sinking into the soft bank. "I've seen you at the grocer's," she said, half question. "Sometimes." He wound the string around his palm. "My father says opportunity comes in slivers, not slices." They fell quiet. Under the hush, something pulsed. Curiosity or caution, a shared sense that if either spoke wrongly, a different story might vanish before it began. "The air," Clara hesitated. "It smells like violets?" Tonio finished, relief flickering across his face. "Thought it was only me." "My sister says that sort of smell means saints or ghosts," he added, a crooked grin daring her to laugh. "Are you fishing for saints, then, or ghosts?" "I take what bites." He rebaited the hook with practiced care. "My pappy thinks it's fertilizer runoff, sweet when it rots." "Lucky, then, not holy," she said, and they both laughed, surprised by how easily sound cut through the stillness. He cast again, splash, expanding rings, and glanced sideways. "You're Clara, right? From Hollinghurst." She nodded. He wiped his hand on his trousers and offered it. "Tonio Esposito." Her smaller palm met his calloused one. "Clara. Moonlight." More idea than light silvered the pond. She crouched, arms around her knees. He sat on a half-sunken log. Shared silence was not absence but a fragile accord. "Do you ever feel watched here?" she asked finally. He stirred the silt with his stick, thinking. "This morning I did. Not a person, something older, hungry for looking." His jaw tightened. "Sometimes I almost see my brother Marco. He died in Naples." Clara weighed that grief. "Places can keep memories," she said softly, surprised at her own certainty. She took out the Kingsley book, fanned its pages. "Explorers find lands that appear only for certain people. My pappy says explorers are boys who got lost on purpose. Then maybe we're both a little lost." The pond shimmered. Ripples twisted against logic, reflecting not the present shore but another. Birches stood in the right place, yet behind them hurried men in blue coats and tricorns, silver buckles flashing, a tableau of revolutionary soldiers crossing time's thin film. One heartbeat, then nothing. Water lay ordinary again. "Did you see?" Tonio whispered. Clara's hand found his sleeve. "Yes, it was real. Or meant for us." They sat so close their knees almost touched. In Tonio's pocket, Marco's broken pencil dug into his thumb. Clara counted her breaths until the violet scent thinned, replaced by mud and smoke and the distant sweetness of falling apples. "We shouldn't tell anyone," she said. "You're afraid?" "Not for me. Mother would say I'm making up tales." "Your family." "Pappy would call it the devil or madness." He plucked a blade of grass, twisting until it snapped. "Promise, then?" "I promise. Only us." She held out her pinky without thinking. He linked his. "Sworn," he said, grave and smiling both. Footsteps crushed leaves behind them. Carlo Esposito emerged from the gloom, broad shoulders, grease still stippled in his nails, worry sharpening his voice. "You're late. Your mother's asked three times." Tonio rose. "Sorry, Poppy." Carlo's gaze slid to Clara, weighing history he knew too well. "Best be careful, both of you. Places like this remember what people forget. To Tonio, home now." To Clara, more gently than she expected. "Night drops quick by water." She murmured thanks, shouldered her satchel, and watched father and son leave. Tonio glanced back, lips shaping tomorrow before darkness swallowed him. Clara hurried south, replaying soldiers on the water, the pact, the warmth of another's silence. Hollinghurst's tower clock began its 8 o'clock warning as she reached the lane. The Esposito kitchen glowed with lamplight. Maria, apron blotched burgundy from beets, scolded with affection. 5 minutes more and I'd have sent Lucia ringing the parish bells. Carlo kissed her brow. Found him dreaming by the pond. Tonio muttered contrition and took his seat. Lucia chattered about schoolyard politics. Carlo spoke of parish repairs. Maria hummed approval or correction. Tonio tasted none of his food. The pact sizzled in his mind like a live wire. After dinner, Carlo steered him to the workshop door, voice pitched low. "No more afternoons with that girl," he said. "Their kind remember favors only when it suits. Stay with your own." "She's not like..." A raised palm cut him off. "Old trouble wears new clothes. I want you safe." "Softer then. Promise me." Tonio nodded, but the promise he had already made felt heavier, truer. Back at Hollinghurst, fewer lamps burned, frugality masquerading as mood. Clara slipped up the rear staircase unheard. Eleanor's voice drifted from a parlor. Discussion of hems, of the charity dinner, only a week away. In her bedroom, Clara dropped the Kingsley book, fingers still tinged with pond water and faint violet metal. The annual dinner, meant to prove Hollinghurst's relevance, loomed. Yet on the ceiling a pawn-shaped shadow shifted with passing headlights, and Clara sensed tomorrow's meeting mattered far more than any silver-plated fundraiser. In Concord that night, dreams pooled shallow around new families and old. Walden waited, secret keeper, oath holder, memory made water. Even emptied of violets, the air remembered their breath. The morning of the Hollinghurst charity dinner broke as if the sun itself hesitated, hovering in the raw September chill, uncertain whether to illuminate expectation or decay. From the outside, the white-columned house looked newly scrubbed, but inside it thrummed like a boiler about to split its seams. In the kitchen, Mrs. Pritchard marshaled her forces. She coaxed blanched string beans into parade-ground lines, persuaded the visiting pastry chef to redo an entire tray of pear tartlets, and pressed a trembling rental boy to polish the Aperdon until you can see St. Peter's keys in it. Pride and fear braided through every command. Failure here was never forgiven, only archived. Eleanor Hollinghurst glided in, the chill of the larder clinging to her oyster-gray silk. She surveyed the preparations with a tactician's eye, arms folded as though restraining the whole enterprise by will alone. "Pritchard, mind the cut. The beans must be uniform." Her voice fell like sleet, hard, cold, brief. "Of course, madam." From a scuffed stool near the pantry door, Clara watched the bustle. Her new dress, ivory lawn with a modest sash, itched at the collar, a reminder that she belonged here only on the family's terms. Concealed in her shawl, Mary Kingsley's travelogue waited like a smuggled friend. She registered every clipped order, every bite of tension, already imagining how the scene might read in someone else's memoir. James appeared, hair slicked back with more hope than skill, a seating chart clamped under one arm. Behind his polished smile lurked the taste of brandy rinsed away only minutes earlier. "Mother, Lady Tremaine refuses to sit beside Mrs. Lamb. Something about a misplaced chapeau last Easter." "Then place her by the arch, two seats left of the bishop," Eleanor said. "If she must glare, let her glare at God." Edward entered next, ledger in hand, shoulders slightly concave as if numbers weighted them. "Are we certain the chrysanthemums won't wilt before the bell? Given the price, I'd prefer they survived inspection." "So is inheritance, Edward," Eleanor replied, already pivoting toward the parlor. "Better they see flowers than frugality." Clara caught the flicker of panic in her father's eyes. The ledger meant another sleepless week of arithmetic alchemy. She knew the signs by heart. Mid-afternoon haze darkened to pewter. Guests began to arrive just as the sky threatened rain. Buicks, Fords, and one defiant Packard coughed up gravel along the drive. Charity, it seemed, traveled first class. Anthony Tonio Esposito slipped from the parish van and adjusted his too large jacket, his father's, taken in at the shoulders by Maria's nimble needle. Cardboard liners dulled the sting of the marble steps beneath his shoes. Carlo had walked him to the service door, squeezing his shoulder in farewell. "Eyes open, words few," he'd advised, the way a sailor instructs a child about rogue waves. Inside, heat and onion and polish mingled. "Mrs." Pritchard's gaze landed on Tonio with brisk appraisal. "Sideboard and water service. Move like a shadow, speak only when pressed." "Yes, ma'am." Eleanor materialized behind her. "Name? Tonio Esposito." She held the surname between finger and thumb, then let it drop. "The Hollinghurst silver is older than you are, Mr. Esposito. Treat it accordingly." Tonio bowed his head. If she noticed the flicker of resentment, she gave no sign. Dusk slid in, thick and metallic. Candlelight feathered across starched linen, and the dining room swelled with murmurs pitched just shy of scandal. The air tasted faintly, impossibly of violets. A single heartbeat later, the scent vanished, swallowed by gravy and wax. Clara, posted midway between hearth and window, lifted her head. Had Tonio caught it too? Across the room he steadied a tray, nostrils flaring. Confirmation enough. The first course arrived. Conversation rose in gentle waves. Lady Tremaine quizzed the bishop on the morality of raffles. The Goldbergs debated stovetop efficiencies. Dr. Speer attempted wit and succeeded in volume. Clara watched, half anthropologist, half reluctant heir, her gaze skimming the doorway every time Tonio entered. Once their eyes met. Electricity, then decorum. Both looked away. James patrolled the perimeter, coat pocket clinking softly with a hip flask he vowed not to open until dessert. At intervals, he leaned in to charm or to coerce, whichever the moment demanded. While clearing bowls, Tonio passed near the head of the table and caught Edward's low, ragged whisper. Another note due Tuesday. If the bank refuses an extension, I've nothing left to mortgage. His companion murmured consolation couched in market jargon. Edward's laugh was the sound of thin ice cracking. He noticed Tonio flushed and fell silent. The boy retreated, ears burning. Debt was a language he knew too well, though he had never heard it spoken in a room trimmed with Waterford crystal. Near the sideboard, Carlo appeared, called up from the kitchen to deliver a new decanter. He signed the ledger for it. Insurance against accusations should anything vanish, and pressed two fingers to Tonio's brow in a half-blessing. "Steady, Figlio," he whispered, then slipped back through the service door. The blessing felt like a promise Tonio wasn't sure he could keep. Between courses, thunder muttered beyond the leaded glass. A low tremor shook the crystal, humming in the hollow of every throat. Mrs. Pritchard signaled the servers forward with the roast. Tonio took the lead, muscles rigid, tray hot through the cloth. James intercepted him beside Eleanor's chair. "Quick hands, Esposito," he said softly. A useful trait in houses like this. Tonio eased the platter onto its stand. "Thank you, sir." James's smile thinned. "You didn't overhear my father fretting about loans, did you? Poor form to eavesdrop. I have work to keep me busy." Tonio kept his eyes on the silver tongs. "Excellent." James pressed a coin into Tonio's palm, a half dollar, cool and heavy. "And if someone from town should ask what you heard tonight, you'll remember you were too busy to listen." A second coin followed, pinched between James's knuckles like a threat disguised as largesse. He folded Tonio's fingers over both. Tonio's pulse flickered under the metal. The coin smelled of tobacco and desperation. "Yes, sir." Across the table, Clara saw the exchange, saw Tonio's shoulders hitch as though the air had turned corrosive. Instinct screamed to intervene, but her mother's gaze raked the room, daring indiscretion. Clara's spoon slipped, whether by accident or intent she could not have said. The clang rang like a shot. All heads turned. Lady Tremaine lifted her lorgnette. The bishop cleared his throat. Tonio crouched to retrieve the spoon, fingertips grazing Clara's as she reached for it. In that brief contact, she felt the coins in his fist, the shame, the mute fury. She met his eyes. A silent question, "Are you all right?" An equally silent answer, "Not yet." Thunder cracked, closer this time. Candle flames flinched, the room's bravado faltered. Eleanor signaled for the next course, voice a precise needle stitching the evening back together. Conversation resumed, tinny and forced, like a brass band marching through fog. Tonio backed toward the corridor, coins burning a brand into his skin. "Keep the secret, earn the money. Betray no one, betray everyone." At the doorway he paused, caught between candlelight and stormlight, and glanced once at Clara. She gave the smallest nod, an acknowledgement that neither of them believed this night was finished. Outside, rain began in needles against the windows, tracing erratic paths down antique glass. Inside, ghosts of debt and violets and unfinished promises drifted between chandelier and floor. The Hollinghurst dinner pressed on, cutlery chiming, guests laughing too loudly, as if noise alone could drown the gathering storm. At dawn, a thin, metallic hammering rose from somewhere in Hollinghurst's bones. Pipes expanding, a branch tapping the eaves, or nerves in revolt. The storm had passed, leaving a predatory hush. Rainwater clung to the window panes like condolence notes no one would claim. Clara lay awake beneath a quilt that smelled of lavender long spent. Cracks in the ceiling mapped a country she neither owned nor understood. Down the hall, her father's voice flared, two words, bitten off, then went under. She pictured him with a ledger flayed open and hope clipped short. It was not a morning for illusions. By 6:30, she had dressed in a wool skirt that hit her shins like restraint and padded up the attic stairs, led by a compulsion she mistook for curiosity. The attic was a reliquary for grudges. Steamer trunks belted with fatigue, hat boxes feathered in dust, a landscape of things kept long after they'd lost all pulse. Something had shifted overnight. One cedar chest, guardian of its own shadows for decades, sat skewed as though nudged by an unseen shoulder. A violet sheen pooled in the east window, daylight or something older. She knelt. The lock surrendered to an impatient twist. The southern hinge groaned once like an admonition. Inside, linen sleeves packed tight as moral advice, sachets brittle with forgotten perfume, a stack of correspondence bound in blackened ribbon. The Hollinghurst crest glinted, gold against ivory, perfectly pleased with itself. Clara eased the letters free. Ink, gone sepia, still breathed sorrow and command. The oldest, dated October 1867, addressed to Charles Hollinghurst, ran 20 pages, formal threat disguised as opportunity. It mentioned a name that hollowed her stomach, Vincenzo Esposito. Charles wrote, "I regret, Signor Esposito, that delays in your account cannot be tolerated. Should settlement not be made by Michaelmas, the orchard tract must revert to Hollinghurst deed." A postscript in smug burgundy ink, "These lands, long ours in custom, must remain so in law, lest chaos supplant order." Vincenzo's reply, careful and foreign-handed, seethed with pride costumed as respect. "My father's orchard has sheltered your men these many winters. To forfeit it now, with harvest blighted, would erase all that binds this town. I beg your reconsideration." There was no reconsideration. The sheaf contained a final notice stamped paid in full by the wrong hand and an unsigned receipt transferring deed and future yield. Tucked behind it, a scrap of faltering Italian repeated three words, casa, onore, perduto, home, honor, lost. Clara pressed the packet to her knees. The attic smelled of moths and iron violets. Guilt, sharper than any perfume, cut the back of her throat. The orchard where she had learned the names of clouds had been torn from Tonio's ancestors by her own. Legacy, she understood, was theft writ pretty. A cough drifted up the stairs, Mrs. Pritchard signaling breakfast. Clara retied the ribbon twice, as though order could pass for atonement, and left the chest open. Some lids, once raised, would never quite shut again. Downstairs, the house convened its rituals. Eleanor sat rigid behind the globe. Edward scanned a telegram with the panic of a man watching his last raft float away. James slept at the table, jaw slack, a glass of water his only shield. Clara arrived carrying shame in paper-cut form. No one noticed. Tonio pedaled toward the workshop, chain clicking like a bad alibi. The post-storm air felt expectant, the hush that precedes either mercy or collision. His father stood outside, boots planted, a letter folded into quarters. Maria hovered beside him, apron still damp from rinsing the night's leaks out of the ceiling. Both wore the taut expressions of people about to pronounce future. "Anthony," Carlo said, formal to the point of tenderness. "Come." Inside, ledgers lay open like arguments. Carlo set the letter on the bench. The Hollinghurst crest squatted at the top. The tone, surprisingly cordial, invited Carlo to discuss purchase of the eastern orchard and derelict barn, tomorrow at noon. It was the property Carlo had inquired about months earlier, back when Hollinghurst still pretended solvency. "They need cash," Carlo said. "I need room. With that barn I could double capacity, hire men, maybe send you to the trade academy next year." Hope flared, then dimmed. Blessings in their family always arrived double-edged, opportunity wrapped around obligation. Tonio kept his voice steady. "That's good news, Poppy." Maria crossed herself out of habit, not certainty. "Bargain hard," she warned. And remember, land keeps score. Carlo's hand tightened on Tonio's shoulder. After school, help me clear the yard. Tonight we celebrate, if God is kind. Mid-morning found Concord shrugging off storm debris. At the grocer, Clara weighed apples she did not intend to buy, the attic letters hot beneath her coat. Mrs. Bent, the postress, asked after Eleanor's migraines. Clara answered automatically, mind elsewhere, ink, ancestors, orchards. Across the street, Tonio emerged from the notary's office, errand complete. When their eyes met, the air contracted. She managed. Tonio, voice low. Prosody rate, morning. He didn't break stride. Meet me after school? The pond. A pause, then a curt nod. Fine. All afternoon, expectation played Clara's nerves raw. She rehearsed confession until the words lost cartilage. At 4, she slipped past Mrs. Pritchard, letters tucked inside her sweater, and walked the long road to Walden. The sky had hardened to pewter. The faint scent of violets rode the wind like rumor. Tonio waited on the bank, knees up, drawing furrows in the water with a stick. He didn't look at her. He felt her arrive. Prosody rate slow. There's something I found, she began, throat sandpapered. Letters, about the orchard. My family took it from yours. Unfairly. He skimmed a pebble so hard it buried itself. Why bring it up now? Because you should know, because it's wrong. He turned, face unguarded, voice low. My father's about to buy that same orchard, thinks it'll make us belong. Did you come to warn me or to absolve yourself? Her breath caught. I came because you're my friend. Friend. The word tasted burnt. Every time I thought you saw me, maybe it was just history staring back. She held the letters out, hands shaking. He recoiled as if they were nettles. Keep them, he said. They're yours. Everything here is. He stood, stick snapping underfoot, and stalked through the knotweed. The violet scent vanished with him, leaving only mud and the thick, metallic taste of failure. Dusk. Hollinghurst's front door slammed. James stumbled in, face gray, envelope stamped hygiene, urgent crushed in his fist. He threw it on the sideboard. Edward opened, read, blanched. The bank demanded immediate settlement, extension denied. Clara hovered in the hallway, invisible as smoke, while disaster rehearsed familiar lines, denial, blame, brandy. Eleanor's voice cut through. We must not let Concord pick our bones. James laughed, brittle. Then we'll sell the bones ourselves, auction the whole damn carcass. Silence thudded. Even the chandelier seemed to brace. So it was decided. Hollinghurst, house, orchard, barns, would go on the block. Clara thought of Carlo's meeting, of Tonio's face pulling shut like a door, too late already. The notice went up next morning in the post office window. On instruction of the Hollinghurst family, public auction, entire estate including orchard and workshops. November 12, 1959, 10 a.m. sharp. By noon, the town had divided into tidy factions. At the parish, Carlo read the notice 3 times, knuckles whitening. Maria whispered a prayer for humility, whether they won or lost. In the bakery, someone toasted the rise of new stock. On the green, old men bet cigars on whether the bank or the Espositos would claim the prize. Clara walked Main Street, feeling every gaze brush her like nettles. Legacy had quit masquerading as privilege. It now wore its true face, raw and owed. That night she slipped from the house barefoot, the packet of letters pressed to her palm, and followed the unlit road to Walden. Moonlight thinned to a razor above treetops. The pond lay black, blank, withholding. She sat on the mudded bank, knees to chest. The cold found her bones, yet the attic's violet trace lingered, iron and flowers, sorrow and promise. Clara, the wind seemed to say. Then other voices, thready, overlapping, languages she recognized only by ache, casa, onore, perduto, home, honor, lost. Choose, they whispered, a command, a plea, a hinge on which futures might turn. She pressed her hand to the water-slick earth and felt a pulse older than blood, steady as tides. History was waiting, patient as water, for her answer. Above, the first hard star pinned itself to the sky. Below, Clara's resolve uncoiled, thin as hope, twice as enduring. Auction morning arrived harder than prophecy, a steel-blue sky frost-stippling what was left of the lawn, every breath showing like evidence. The Hollinghurst estate, columns scrubbed, hedges trimmed within an inch of apology, stood at parade rest, dignity itemized for sale. A white canvas tent sprawled across the gravel drive, its bunting sagging like second thoughts. Vans and battered trucks parked nose to tail beside polished Buicks, the mingled smell of exhaust and violets drifting over the crowd. Clara Hollinghurst, 13 and suddenly ancient, kept to the tent's margin. Beneath her mother's moth-scented coat, she carried a packet of 19th-century letters, proof her family had once stolen the orchard now being auctioned. Paper that old should have felt light. Instead, it dragged at her like an anchor. Closer to the lectern, James smoothed his tie until the silk frayed above an artery that fluttered like a trapped moth. Edward paced with a ledger clutched to his ribs. Eleanor, armor-clad in dove-gray wool, surveyed the gathering with a gaze that weighed debts as easily as silverware. The auctioneer, Mr. Hawthorne, tapped the microphone. His voice, seasoned on foreclosures, rolled out the terms. Clear title, 10% deposit, all lots sold as is. Nothing in the script mentioned the quiet desperation vibrating under every coat. Near the rear ropes stood Anthony, Tonio, Esposito beside his father. Carlo's best jacket strained across his shoulders. Tonio's was a hand-me-down pressed thin overnight. One pocket hid the folded bank draft that represented Carlo's dream of buying back the East Orchard and its derelict barn. Maria rocked the baby's pram with one foot, murmuring a prayer neither hopeful nor fearful, just practiced. 7-year-old Lucia gripped her father's fingers, eyes wide at the spectacle of grandeur unbuttoning itself. Hawthorne called Lot 1, the manor house and bitter remnants of the front garden. 50,000, said the bank's agent, voice as dry as dust. A paddle rose, then another. Numbers climbed with polite ferocity. 55, 60, 62. Clara edged backward until the tent canvas brushed her shoulders. There, half hidden by the side flap, she finally spotted Tonio. Their gazes clicked like flint. No smile, no nod, just the silent acknowledgement that everything important sat on a blade's edge. Lot 3, the East Orchard and both barns. Mr. Costin of the mill lifted his paddle. 64. Silence thinned. Carlo's jaw flexed. At last he raised his number. 65. A ripple ran through the crowd. Admiration, surprise, a smudge of contempt. Costin hesitated, tasted the mood, and lifted again. 67. Clara's fists tightened around the letters. She could almost hear ink scratching across time. Casa, onore, perduto, home, honor, lost. Her father's ledger creaked as Edward recalculated futures already spent. Eleanor's chin lifted a degree. If the orchard fetched enough, perhaps the manor might survive. Costin and Carlo traded bids. 68, 69, 70. Each figure struck Tonio like a hammer. One more step between his family and belonging. Hawthorne's cadence sped, chasing the thrill. Then the air itself shifted. It began as a tremor underfoot, no louder than a far-off freight car. Conversation stuttered. The tent poles shivered. A second rumble followed, deep and deliberate, as though the earth cleared its throat. Someone near the flap muttered, "Ice breaking on the river." Another, "No river within 5 miles." Clara knew that sound. Walden had made it the night the orchard bloomed out of season. Her pulse answered like struck glass. Somewhere behind her, Eleanor hissed her name, but the warning came too late. Clara was already moving. She broke from the tent and sprinted across frost-whitened grass. A moment later, Tonio followed, boots hammering the ground. Voices chased them, James's rasp, Hawthorne's bewildered bark, Carlo's startled shout, but none could match the urgency pumping through their legs. past the orchard fence, into the thin copse, down the rutted track. Every breath hauled knives of cold air. When Walden finally spread before them, the pond looked forged from pewter, its rim laced with new ice. They skidded to a stop. The violet perfume thickened, metal sweet, as if the water itself exhaled. Clara hugged her arms, breath ragged. "It wasn't a storm," she said. "It was calling us." Tonio nodded, eyes on the pond. "Because something's still wrong." Specters stirred in the mirrored surface. First shadows, then shapes wearing long coats and immigrant shawls. A Hollinghurst ancestor etched a line in frost with his boot heel. Opposite him a dark-haired man, Tonio's great-great-grandfather perhaps, held a crumpled cap to his chest. Between them stood a child, neither fully girl nor boy, face a shifting echo of Clara and Tonio both. Voices rose, braided English and Italian, urgent yet resigned. Debts must be paid. The orchard feeds children. Paper is not soil. Words Clara had never read, but somehow understood. The deed snapped loose from the ledger and drifted onto the water, refusing to sink. The specters turned, looking straight through time at the two living witnesses. "Choose," they murmured, not accusation, but offering. Tonio crouched, palm hovering above the ice. "We can't undo what they did," he whispered, "but we can end repeating it." Clara withdrew the letters, set them on the ice. Ink bled outward, threads of sepia looping like roots beneath the surface. "We choose together," she said. The pond pulsed, a heartbeat felt more than heard. Frostbright petals curled up from the shoreline, spiraling between the children and the fading ancestors. When the vision ebbed, only the letters remained, their corners rimmed in frost, but the words still legible. "Proof and perhaps permission." Tonio straightened. "We go back," he said, voice steadier than his shaking hands. "Tell the truth. Let them laugh if they want." "No more secrets," Clara agreed. Resolve filled her coat like sudden warmth. They ran. The auction tent reemerged, a white wound against winter grass. Inside, Hawthorne struggled to restore order. Carlo's hand was raised, 75,000, his jaw clenched for the next blow. Costin twitched, preparing a counter. Clara burst through a gap between folding chairs. Conversation snapped shut, paddles froze midair. Eleanor's expression cracked. Edward's pen hovered. James swore under his breath. Mr. Hawthorne's mouth stayed open, the number unfinished. Tonio arrived behind her, chest heaving, hair wild, eyes alight with what they had witnessed. Clara lifted the frost-edged letters high so all could see. "I," she began, voice trembling but clear. "I must." A wind, violet-scented, undeniable, swept the tent, rattling bunting and bone alike. Somewhere a child's voice echoed across decades, ringing. "I must." Clara tried again, louder this time. "Tell you." "I must," she said at last, "tell you all something before another bid is called." Every eye inside the auction tent swung toward the girl in the too large coat. Pale morning light slanted through the canvas roof, limning dust and expectation alike. Hawthorne laid a protective hand over the microphone as if it were a skittish animal. "Miss Hollinghurst, we are in the middle of..." "Exactly," she said, words tumbling yet clear, "in the middle of repeating an old wrong." She raised the packet of letters, edges still rimmed with pond frost, high above her head. "A century ago, my family foreclosed on the Esposito orchard after promising otherwise. They stole a livelihood and called it business. The proof is here. And now we're selling the land again, as though history left no fingerprints." A gasp rippled through the crowd, quilting circle whispers, banker throat clears, the soft crack of Costin's knuckles around his paddle. James licked his lips, tasting the varnish of panic. Eleanor's spine straightened, a blade sliding back into its scabbard. Tonio moved to Clara's side, not touching, but close enough that their shoulders almost brushed. He felt the burn of every stare, yet a strange calm settled over him, like stepping through thunder into sudden silence. Clara's voice softened. I'm 13, Mr. Hawthorne, not a lawyer, but I know a promise matters more than a deed if the promise was broken first. So I'm asking, no, at insisting, the orchard be taken off the block until the people of Concord decide together what should become of it, of all of this. James found his tongue. Clara, you have no authority to. I have the truth, she shot back, startling even herself, and you have debts that will hound you whether this land sells or not. So maybe listen. Edward, ledger clutched like a life jacket, exhaled a tremor of relief. Someone had spoken the word debts aloud. At last the pretense had cracked. Eleanor stepped forward, winter eyes narrowing. If we do this, Clara, understand the cost. The roof, the staff, the family itself may not survive delay. Clara met her mother's gaze and for the first time did not look away. Then let something better survive instead. Silence, as tight as an overwound watch, held for three breaths. James broke it, voice stripped of charm. My gambling debts forced father to refinance the estate. I'll meet the collectors myself. His shoulders sagged, the surrender strangely freeing. I won't drag the rest of you down any farther. Edward nodded, ledger finally closing with a quiet thud. And I will speak with our creditors about restructuring. Perhaps, in good faith, they'll accept land use profits over liquidation. Eleanor's lips parted, objection maybe, but what emerged was a long, weary sigh. If we do this, she said, we do it openly, no more behind-door bargains. Across the aisle, Maria Esposito touched Carlo's sleeve. Pride feeds no one, cuore mio. At least hear them. Carlo's jaw worked. He had imagined owning the orchard outright. Keys in his pocket, ghosts quiet at last. Yet the picture before him, his son standing beside the Hollinghurst girl, the town listening for once, felt oddly like justice. We talk, he said. Tomorrow. Church hall, after mass, everyone welcome. A collective exhale passed through the tent. Old rivals shook hands. Onlookers filed toward the flap, dazed as theatergoers after an unexpected ending. Only then did the air change. A breeze rolled in, metal sweet, violet sharp, lifting bunting, ruffling skirts. Heads turned toward the avenue of walnut trees guarding the drive. From every branch, pale blossoms curled open, absurd in midwinter, petals catching weak sun and holding it like lantern glass. They drifted free, spiraling over parked Buicks and battered trucks, settling on shoulders and hair. Children shrieked delight. Adults crossed themselves or simply stared. Even the banker let a blossom land on his palm, the tough-mouthed man blinking as if snow had fallen upward. Tonio laughed, a sound Clara had never heard from him. Rich, startled, utterly unafraid, she felt her own laughter rise, cleansed of bitterness. All these years, she murmured, watching petals settle on the auctioneer's hat, the land waited for us to choose. Then we'd better keep choosing, Tonio said, and together they stepped into the falling light. Years turned the scandal into a story, the story into a tradition. The Hollinghurst columns remained, but the name on the gate changed to Concord House, carved by Tonio's hand, gilded with paint Lucia mixed herself. Upstairs parlors became classrooms. The old ballroom rang with Italian folk songs one night and square dance fiddles the next. Carlo expanded the foundry in the East Barn, hiring veterans and teenagers alike. Maria oversaw a canning cooperative, its jars stamped with twin crests, a walnut leaf entwined with a gear. The ledger Edward once guarded now lived behind glass in the entry hall, open to the page where the debts reached zero. James ran auctions still, but for charity. Each event closed with a toast of orchard cider to honest accounts and even odds. He remained stubbornly sober. Eleanor, gray turning silver, presided over a community board that argued fiercely and more often than not found consensus. When asked why she tolerated so much noise, she said only, a quiet house is a dead one. As for Clara and Tonio, they grew beside each other the way vines claim the same trellis, sometimes tangling, sometimes giving slack, never so far apart that one could not reach the other's hand. When Tonio opened a small forge beside Walden, Clara donated the first shelves for his metal-bound ledgers, quipping that somebody had to keep his numbers honest. He replied that molten iron was easier to handle than editors. Some evenings, when the apple blossoms scented the warm air, townsfolk swore the walnuts bloomed again, though no botanist confirmed it. Children chased petals, or fireflies, or perhaps only rumors under branches that remembered. 15 springs after the halted auction, Walden lay hushed under dawn. Shoots of grass pressed through last year's mats, water black as blown glass. Clara arrived first, book in hand, cheeks flushed from the walk. She closed her eyes, letting the hush settle. No Latin drills awaited her now, only the low hum of frogs, the faint tang of violets that had no right to be there. Footsteps. She turned. Tonio approached, taller and surer, sleeves rolled, wrists smudged with graphite. He carried a canvas bag from which protruded the edge of an iron sign. Concord House, freshly repainted. Delivery, he said, setting the sign against a boulder. Payment due in laughter and maybe coffee. Always raising your prices, Clara teased. She reached out, brushing an old scar on his knuckle, the souvenir of a forge spark years ago. They sat on the bank, knees almost touching. The silence between them felt as full as any hymn. You ever regret it? Tonio asked at last. Stopping the sale? Only on bookkeeping days, she admitted with a grin. Then, more softly, no, because every ledger line I balance now writes over one that used to hurt. Tonio considered the pond, its surface riffled by a single breeze. Marco would have liked this place, he said. Long afternoons, nothing pressing but the next cast of the fishing line. Clara laid her hand atop his solid, calloused, warm. Maybe he's here already. Maybe every violet-scented breeze is someone remembered right. Across the water, a ripple shivered outward, as if the pond itself nodded. A branch dipped, scattering last year's leaves. And in that hush before birdsong, they both heard it, a whispered syllable neither English nor Italian, but kin to each. They rose. Tonio hefted the new sign, Clara collected her book. Together they followed the track back toward the orchard, where sap-sticky trees awaited pruning and children awaited stories. Behind them, Walden stilled, its secrets safe for another season. But the air, fresh, impossible, and faintly violets, kept the memory alive, ready for whoever next chose to listen. Thank you for choosing A Story Publishing.